So hello and welcome. I guess we'll get going. Thank you for coming. Firstly, you're a pretty hardy bunch indeed, given that it's 5 o'clock on a Saturday, and a lot of your conference colleagues, I presume, are, if not at a bar, on their way there. I know that if I wasn't speaking, that's probably where I would be. And you've also had to endure and brave the rain as well. So I consider it my responsibility over the next hour or 55 minutes to make it worthwhile for you and worthwhile missing a drink, sitting here in the semi-subdued light listening to me. My name's Guy Gould-Davis. I work for Sapient Nitro. We're an experience company that combines marketing services with technology. We create experiences that connect people to brands to deliver value for our clients. Digital is at the heart of what we do, but it's understanding people, human-centered design, that really shapes how we use technology for the experiences we create. Now, I'm an experienced strategist, but at the heart and soul, I'm a marketer. My passion is motivating people to buy. So the title of today's talk, the idea of maps serving the human condition, might seem lofty or academic. And it's true. Over the next hour, I'll touch on the fields of psychology, social cartography, cognitive anthropology, sociology, and even existentialism. But as I hope to demonstrate, the link between maps and the human condition is far from theoretical. In fact, it's fundamental to who we are, to how we live, and in business, for making money. There's been a fundamental shift in the landscape of maps, from navigating the physical conditions around us to the human condition. From making journeys in the outside world, maps are now helping us with an inner journey, one enabling us to achieve greater fulfillment, which is a universal human ambition. It will require, however, thinking about maps slightly differently. Here's arguably one of the best maps ever created. It's by Charles Minard. You might be familiar with it. It's of Napoleon's march on Moscow as part of the Russian campaign of 1812. Beginning at the Poland-Russian border, the thick band, the sort of beige-colored band there, represents the size of the advancing army. The path of Napoleon's retreat from Moscow is depicted underneath it in black. Army casualties are shown relative to three other data points: distance traveled, time, and the prevailing temperatures. It's a great infographic, but it doesn't qualify as a map for today's discussion. It's not that it's because the map's historic, per se, because, as you'll see a little later, a part of the value of digital maps is in their ability to provide a backwards-looking view, one of assessment, which contributes to forward progress. The reason why it doesn't qualify as a map for today's topic is because it doesn't support future action. Even though it's an accomplished way to convey knowledge, it doesn't lead anywhere. Being a marketer, action and forward momentum is a key objective that must be achieved. So that for the purposes of today, here's how I'm defining a map: a visual representation of a space in support of future action. This is the standard by which we should assess digital maps and their ability to move people by being useful and supporting a goal. So why do maps matter? In the literal sense, it's because we're meant to move. Biomechanically, our bodies are designed for it and depend on it to remain well. Maps also matter because we know we're going to die. That might sound like an odd thing to say, but knowledge of our mortality and the sense of a limited time alive gives us important motivation to make the best use of it. The idea of moving forward is not uniquely human, but it is a fundamental one. Maps matter because of this quest to move forward, to go somewhere. Importantly, mapping occurred as a mental activity before the emergence of the first artifact, much like speech preceded written language. According to cognitive anthropologists, our brains are hardwired to create mental maps to help us navigate the world around us. The activity was significant among our ancestors, and it has been claimed contributed to the evolution of our species. When we map, we plan. And the ability to form mental maps and to share their contents with members of a social group provided our ancestors with a tremendous cognitive advantage. This is one of the earliest maps ever made by man, or perhaps ever discovered. It's an incised block of stone weighing about a kilogram and was found in Navarro, northern Spain, dating to about 14,000 BC. There are numerous lines and shapes on its surface, which experts refer to as layers. The artifact shows a landscape layer with geographical features of the valley surrounding the cave and the site where the map was found. If this was all, this wouldn't fulfill the definition of the map I just gave you, because it wouldn't implicitly support an action. But there's an animal layer whose lines represent hunting routes. Anthropologists conclude that this map was a tool for action, guiding people on the best places to hunt for different kinds of animals. The way early maps behaved had a distinct character. The space they were about was purely geographic. The form they existed in was purely an artifact, in this case, a lump of stone or rock. They were the subject, and the users of maps had to bend to understand the map and its code. There was nothing personal about the connection to that map. It was impersonal. In fact, its value was that it was inherently social because it enabled knowledge of a distinct area to be shared by many people. It was fixed. It wasn't dynamic. It was a lump of rock. And there was no time element to it. It was a static representation of the geography and animal routes as it existed at that time. Digital's extended geographic wayfaring in new and interesting ways. Let's jump forward 16,000 years to 2010 for the last World Cup. Soccer fans wanted to find bars where they could watch games. Part of that fun comes from watching a game with fellow supporters. In some cases, it's easy to tell from a pub's name what supporters it will attract. Much like the name of the bar Agave in Las Vegas would attract Mexican supporters. But in other cases, affiliation isn't so clear, as with the Ballard Loft in Seattle. And it presents a challenge for supporters trying to find a supportive rather than a hostile environment. For the last World Cup, basic geographic wayfaring wouldn't have been enough to help soccer fans affirm their tribal ties. Bing teamed up with Foursquare and Thrillist to add a social layer to the map, one not inherent in the geographic space itself. And it's a usefulness that simply wasn't possible before the digital age. An even richer development in social navigation comes from sense networks, which launched CitySense in 2008. It's an innovative mobile application for real-time nightlife discovery, ones we might find helpful here in Austin during South by Southwest. Say you're out for a night looking for a good club to go to. Who wants to be at one that's empty? Who wants to stand in line for hours? Well, thanks to CitySense, you don't have to. On an opt-in basis, it collects movement data or location data in real time for devices with GPS or Wi-Fi positioning technology, such as mobile phones and even cars. It's captured anonymously. There's no personally identifiable information connected with each data source. The movement data is combined with historical data too. CitySense passively senses the most popular places and possible places based on actual real-time activity, and from it displays a live heat map. The application intelligently leverages the inherent wisdom of crowds in order to navigate people to the hottest spots in the city. It even integrates with popular recommendation engines such as Yelp and Google. CitySense literally reimagines search from a fixed listing of options in a category to one based on the level of activity or traffic, which is inherently social and constantly in flux. This kind of digital map helps you find a club in the sweet spot, one that has enough people at, but not too many. Maps have evolved well beyond navigating a geographic space. They've extended into medicine, and it occurred even before the digital and internet eras emerged. It began with the invention of photographic imaging in 1890, whose first medical application occurred in 1895 with the X-ray. CT and MRI scans followed in 1967 and 1974, respectively, and are used for a variety of purposes like neuroimaging, neuroscience in the form of functional MRIs, and perhaps portraying its geographic-minded origin, anatomical topography. But you may ask, are these applications of digital technology maps? I would put it to you that they are. They're visual representations that support behavior, and they materially facilitate a diagnosis resulting in future medical action. Now, the state of our health is a foundation for how we live our lives, but maps aren't limited to supporting only our physical condition. They help us navigate the rest of what makes us who we are. In other words, the human condition. For the film buffs among us, What is the Human Condition? Would be a trilogy by the acclaimed storyteller Masaaki Kobayashi. It's considered a masterpiece for capturing its essence. The human condition can be defined as the unique and inescapable features of being human, whether in a social, cultural, or personal context. It is the irreducible part of humanity that is inherent and universal, not connected to factors such as gender, race, or class. The chap on the right is Ivan Yalom. He's an existential psychotherapist, considered by many an authority on the subject. He believes the human existence is characterized by four main preoccupations: a lack of meaning, a lack of freedom, a lack of isolation, and mortality. You might notice that he doesn't look very happy. And perhaps it's not surprising given his rather bleak characterization of the human condition. The chap on the left is Abraham Maslow. He looks a lot happier, I think you'd agree. And in 1946, he articulated the human condition in a different, more positive way in the form of motivations. Far from being equal, Maslow believed the needs exist in a hierarchy, with relatively lower needs having to be met first before one's able to focus on satisfying ones higher up. The most basic needs are for food, water, warmth, and shelter, physiological in nature, followed by safety and security, the next level up. Above them are the needs for belonging and love, followed by accomplishment and prestige needs, which are connected to our drive for esteem. And the highest level relates to our need to achieve our potential or to self-actualize. Jane McGonigal yesterday talked about this in her session. She suggested a fulfilled life did not come from the pursuit of happiness, but rather happiness lay in the pursuit of achievement mediated through a gaming experience. These fundamental needs trigger goals, and our drive to accomplish them is the impetus behind most human endeavor. Notice that Yalom and Maslow's constructs are related, avoidance tendencies correlating with goal-based activity. Mortality equates with physiological and safety. Isolation avoidance triggers a drive for belonging, both through social and personal connections. And lack of freedom translates into exercising control, one that's implicit in an individual's ability to reach successively higher goals. Meaninglessness is assuaged by realizing one's potential and achieving significance, which constitutes a form of purpose. I open today's talk with a point that the landscape of maps has shifted from physical conditions to the human condition. Considering them both contexts or spaces to navigate, they each have a very different character. But there are two reasons why they are both served by maps so well. The first is goal-directed behavior. It's fundamental to human nature. It's fundamental to satisfying the needs that our existence and fulfillment depend upon. And it's fundamental in driving our use and creation of maps. The second element they both have in common, and the reason why maps are deeply connected to the human condition, is through a cognitive activity I referred to earlier, our capacity to create mental maps. Maps serve our basic need to find our way. In anthropology, it goes by the rather cumbersome term spatial wayfaring. Spatial wayfaring is more basic to human experience than geographic navigation. It is the primitive, persistent mechanism that helps us navigate any context of interdependent relationships in support of a goal. It helps us make our way towards goals in any areas of our lives. Our connection to space and mental mapping runs deep and has many origins. According to the anthropologist Robert Rundstrom, mental mapping is fundamental to the process of lending order to the world. There's evidence in Jean Piaget's work of the development of a mapping capability that parallels cognitive development in children. An evolutionary relationship has been found between spatial consciousness and language. Some have gone further to suggest the centrality of space is rooted in human consciousness. Our connection to space has a plausible biological basis, playing a role in how we remember. The role of the neocortex is to create and store memories in the form of maps. It's not surprising, therefore, that experiences needed to produce memories should also have a link to space and maps. Ivan Brady, writing in the Visual Anthropology Review, describes a tangible map as, I quote, an external expression of internal ideas and arrangement of ideas, one with the potential to represent all forms of experience. These two related dynamics, goal-directed behavior and spatial wayfaring, are the reason why the human condition is so well served by maps, and digital mapping in particular. They serve to connect us emotionally to a goal and help us make progress towards it over time. Now, ideally, we'd prefer in many situations to simply reduce the distance between ourselves and a goal. In practice, however, our progress towards a goal is about finding a more direct route to it and avoiding a circuitous one. Our keen interest in doing so comes from the fact that we have time, energy, and money in limited supply. Let's take a look at the goal of becoming a better skier. There's a truism of any travel. Nobody wants to return home and wish they'd spent their time better. Whether it's on skiing or snowboarding trips, it can be a real problem. Arriving at a resort, you're usually confronted with largely unfamiliar terrain and a lot of choices. The result is less time spent on what you came to do and more time trying to figure out what to do and in what order. Vail Resorts understood this, and it drove a marketing ambition to help guests, quite literally, get more from the mountain. They launched Epic Mix in 2010. Epic Mix is a digital map both of the mountain and dynamically of people's movement around it using RF technology.
There have always been mountains. But it wasn't until someone came up with the idea to ride them that things really got interesting. Followed by the desire to build trails, high-speed lifts, mountain resorts, and vibrant base villages. Soon, the mountain wasn't just a mountain anymore. It was a playground, filled with energy and creative expression. Today, a new generation is taking it to new heights, and it's time the mountain evolved again. Introducing Epic Mix, the key to unlocking a new mountain experience. Epic Mix is an online and mobile app that captures your ski experience. It connects you with your friends and family on the mountain. It allows you to share your stories, achievements, and then some. It all starts with your season pass or lift ticket already enabled with RF technology. The Epic Pass, Summit Pass, Colorado Pass, Heavenly Pass, and Peaks Lift Ticket. They're all smarter than the common paper ticket. And once you buy one, you're in the mix. You're automatically part of the Epic Mix experience. When you get to a lift, you'll be scanned just as before with our easy scan process. No need to take your pass out of your pocket. No fumbling with your gloves. Just get on the lift and go. Then start riding. Make some powder turns. Hit the summit. Find a new favorite run. That's all you need to do. Epic Mix has done the rest. It records each of your lift routes, calculates your vertical feet skied, and tallies your epic ski days. And to see it all, you just need to access your account from your computer or mobile phone, and your stats, maps, and achievements that tell the story of your epic day or epic season will be waiting for you, even for those under the age of 13, at the Epic Mix Kids site with its own privacy settings and features. But Epic Mix is more than just tracking vertical feet and a count of your ski days. It captures your experience by rewarding your special achievements and epic moments with Epic Mix pins. We've created pins for hundreds of milestones, special adventures, and unique accomplishments for each day, for each season, and for each resort. Each time you accomplish one, you unlock a new pin that's added to your collection. If you already use Facebook and Twitter, it's easy to share your Epic Mix pins and other achievements with friends and family by connecting your accounts with Epic Mix. When you earn a new pin, you don't need to write a tweet or Facebook status update yourself. You can set up your account to automatically update your social networks and instantly show your friends and family members your epic mountain adventures. We designed Epic Mix Mobile to go where you go. Just download the free Android or iPhone app, or connect to the mobile website and have access to all your mix information anytime. But it's not just about bragging or broadcasting. Epic Mix Mobile shows you which of your friends are on the mountain and where. Gives you tools to message your friends and easily set up places to meet. And provides weather forecasts, traffic conditions, mountain updates, snow reports, and more. Skiing and riding have always been social experiences. Sharing stories with friends and family at the end of a great day has been part of the mountains since the very beginning. Now, Epic Mix brings that same tradition into the 21st century. With Epic Mix, the mountain is evolved once again. This season, you'll experience the mountain like never before.
Maps are used for many things, but first and foremost, it's to plan. Better planning means better time spent. And long before guests arrive, Epic Mix lets them plan the activities they want to do. Once on the mountain, the power of digital mapping really takes off. Each guest RF pass, as you heard in the video, is read at ski lifts. The results feed a dashboard of personal achievements, whether it's key stats like vertical feet. It also incorporates where photos were taken on the mountain and enables you to share them. Also included are the digital pins awarded for a variety of accomplishments. Epic Mix also has community elements and social media integration, as you heard, but what makes it most dynamic and useful is the ability to digitally map movement while guests ski about. It gives each guest the ability to shape the experience while it's happening, in the moment. The mobile app updates a guest's map during the day while that's still on the mountain. Not only can guests adapt and change the course of their day, the system Vail has put in place has the ability to selectively reach out to guests and suggest experience-enhancing possibilities that are based on guest behavior on the mountain. This kind of digital mapping has transformed the winter sports experience for guests. It's also provided a management tool for Vail as well. The company has the challenge of a very fixed inventory and the unpredictability of guest traffic. The result can be overcrowding at times. Between 2 and 4 p.m. at one of its mountains, North Star, it promotes pins deliberately in less trafficked areas, precisely to ease congestion. To close on Epic Mix, a couple of notable things about the digital mapping capability. First, it's not work to use. It's built into every pass, and it captures activity from the first ski lift taken. Even if guests don't find out about the service until during or after their trip, they're able to see the map of achievements they have from their time on the mountain. It's also free, and that was no accident. The purposeful approach to lower hurdles to adoption was foremost in the minds of Vail when they came up with the idea. Sharing is another significant part of the map tool and experience. As I mentioned earlier, there's an inherently social quality to maps. But adding to that, skiing is an inherently social activity. Epic Mix not only helps groups coordinate on the mountain, it lets groups create custom leaderboards. It supports group, not just individual, goal-directed behavior. The value of sharing was a key drive behind the launch of Epic Mix Photo in 2011, and my firm, Sapient Nitro, was the lead digital partner for experience design. Photos are social currency, and the ability to attach them to where they were taken on the mountain and send them immediately into the social space has redefined the idea of shared experience. You'll remember that one of the challenges that Yolande was wrestling with in the human condition was that of a lack of meaning. Reflecting on experience is one way for us to connect to meaning as a way of explaining what has happened. We spend much time pondering the past as well as projecting the meaning found there into future intent. Thus, Epic Mix Collage is part of the digital map Vail provides. For each guest, it represents the total of lists taken, vertical feet ski, digital pins, and photos for each trip that can be curated into a summary collection. It makes a pretty cool memento and something that feeds future planning. So let's turn to gaming. Call of Duty, you might have heard, is the largest entertainment property in the history of gaming. Every night, it's played by more than 5 million people worldwide. Sapient Nitro is the lead digital partner for Call of Duty, as well as some other Activision titles. You might have noticed Epic Mix uses some game mechanics in its experience design, and gaming itself is an ideal context for digital mapping because the intrinsic nature of the activity is about making progress towards a goal. Let's look at both these elements with Call of Duty. While completing the game is the overarching macro-level goal, making progress towards a goal is a repeated drama throughout the game. Each time players spend at the console, they go through an explore, discover, learn arc on their way to the next level. Elite is the digital mapping capability with Call of Duty that shows progress along the way. Wherever players are in the game on this repeated cycle, Call of Duty and Elite lets them connect to their personal goals. It allows them to customize their view so they can see their distance for the goal that matters to them. Here you can see a calculator that lets a gamer decide their starting point, both in terms of prestige, class, and level, and then choose what goals they want to have, if you excuse the pun, in their sight. Not just the one that's closest in gameplay. And it factors in the amount of time it thinks the gamer wants to play or will be able to play. And here you can see what it looks like at the bottom there, underneath the sort of teal-colored bar. It identifies that there are 4.2 months for this particular gamer to be able to reach prestige level 3. Elite enables players to see their progress to goals relative to other folks as well. Just like this leaderboard that shows it on the basis of kills and wins and accuracy. But it goes further in helping a group make progress towards a collective goal. This is important because multiplayer mode is one of the most popular forms of gaming for many first-person shooter titles. Both the game itself and Elite Mapping Tool are great examples of social mapping, not only the sense of seeing where players are in the game, but the capability to coordinate and orchestrate activities to achieve a collective outcome. Let's turn to another key aspect of the human condition, the search for love. eHarmony is one of the largest companies in the online dating space. It's a category worth some $900 million a year in the US alone. This suggests it's an important activity to quite a lot of people. eHarmony has been helping people find their match since 2000, and today I'll talk about one goal that eHarmony serves, which is finding love, as opposed to expediting hookups or for serial daters. And they serve those goals well, apparently. The irony of online dating is that most people think they know what's best for them, and they don't want to be told otherwise. It can unwittingly create the very obstacles that impede progress towards their goal. Let's take choice. It's a paradox. People are tempted to want more, but it's a kind of trap. People can get overwhelmed by the amount of choice, and it plays out in the online dating space. eHarmony understands that too much choice works against its customers' interests, and it takes a different approach. eHarmony believes that compatibility is something that can be predicted from sufficient knowledge about an individual's behavior and characteristics. It has customers complete a questionnaire based on 29 dimensions of compatibility, shown here like the periodic table of elements. eHarmony manages the choice by providing a smaller, denoted by the blue triangle there, a smaller but higher quality pool of possible matches than the wider sea of choices people would otherwise encounter searching online. In one sense, restricting the freedom to choose from the vast database of members might be considered a bad idea, but it's done with sound reason and backed with a method that encourages more commitment than other approaches. It also helps overcome another hurdle to progress, which people themselves bring to their attempt to achieve a goal, which is to temper the distorted perception people often bring to their search. It starts with a small truth, one in fact we may all have harbored at some point in time, which is that we think we're hotter than we are. The effect is not benign. It distorts our view of the playing field, our perception of who's worthy enough to be our partner. It inflates our expectations and our demands. A cohort of candidates based on self-assessment is better than subjective assessment of photos with limited profiles. The examples I've just shared with you have illustrated pursuit of a goal that's simple. Each was simple because it involves a single activity, like skiing or gaming. But digital maps are also immensely helpful in helping people achieve a complex goal. A goal is complex when it requires progress to be made several ways at once. Fitbit is an example of a digital mapping for a complex goal, a goal of getting fit. Now, getting fit sounds easy, but any of us here who've ever tried doing it before know that it simultaneously requires eating right, exercising, and getting enough good sleep to achieve. And that's what Fitbit does. The Fitbit system incorporates data on three different areas. 3D motion sensor tracks both activity and sleep to a very high level of detail, providing users with comprehensive stats on the amount of steps taken, floors climbed, calories burned, and time slept each day. Both mobile apps and online tools encourage users to log details about their workouts, meals, weight, heart rate, and glucose levels, and more to supplement those stats that are uploaded automatically from the sensors to the system. The result is that users are able to analyze their day across various measures, as well as chart progress towards achieving specific goals over time. Fitbit is much more advanced as a form of digital mapping, and much more effective in its capacity to help people move forward. Just like the fundamental of any map is to support a goal and provide alternative ways of getting there, so the practical reality of most people in trying to reach goals is that they need choice along the way. They need to vary the rate or nature of progress from what was initially planned, based on unanticipated developments, whether a setback or faster progress. Fitbit allows a different path to be chosen on the way to a goal, and uses performance, like a setback in one area, to change the progress needed in a related area, like reducing the number of calories allowed because the amount of exercise has declined. Fitbit also allows its users to change a goal along the way. Nike promotes itself as a performance and achievement brand, which is somewhat ironic because Nike Plus's approach to helping customers make progress is classic destination myopia. It locks the user into a goal and doesn't allow people the freedom to either change it or make changes in the path towards it. The ability to do that is not only very useful, it fits the reality of most people's life experience of making progress towards most goals. So, why did the evolution in digital maps occur? Most recently, a cultural force has been at work. Increasingly, people want to participate in and shape choices and outcomes. They're able to do so through a remarkable variety of customization possibilities, both of products and experiences that marketers deliver. With the emergence of social media, we've also seen the rising appetite people have to not just align with brands, but participate in them. It's led to people's expectation that they are not merely consumers of brands, but co-creators. There's also something of a measurement culture emerging. Nike recently showcased basketball shoes with the ability to measure how high a basketball player has jumped. And they're promoting footwear with sensors that show on the sole of the foot the pressure being applied. We will, I think, see an explosion in the application of sensors to products and experiences in all areas of life, not unlike the Fitbit product I was talking about. Measurement culture is still here, well before the diffusion of sensors in product manufacturing. Gamification is upon us, and that in itself is a form of measurement-based endeavor. The other major force is technology, which has come in three main thrusts. First, hardware has become cheaper, and its performance has become increasingly better. Data, not just in the form of cheaper storage, but the creation of advanced tools and systems to combine it. And access, in the form of networking and open standards. These forces are recent, but they've been preceded by a long period of innovation and integration without which today's possibilities would not be happening. Beginning with the geographic information systems in the 1960s, advancements in microprocessors and the precursor to the RFID technology in the 1970s, web in the 1980s, and the first map server providing real maps on demand from data through the Palo Alto Research Center, and open source web mapping making applications possible in 1995, which led to MapQuest's launch a year later. I want to share with you a recent development of a digital mapping technology that connects with the human condition. It has to do with emotions. Emotions are a core part of the human condition, not just because we wouldn't be human if we didn't have them, but they are key to decisions we make and to actions we take. Jonah Lehrer, in his excellent 2009 book, How We Decide, gives a fascinating account of a man who had an injury to part of his brain responsible for emotional processing, rendering him unable to have feelings. This made things rather challenging for his wife. But the other casualty was that he was unable to make a decision. The man could articulate options, but was unable to make a choice. The point Lehrer underscores is this: we have to connect with emotion to make a decision. Connecting with people's emotions, indeed shaping those emotions, is a fundamental concern of every marketer. The latest development in this area comes from Realize, a UK-based company with automated facial coding technology. Those are the somewhat strange-looking green dots that you can see over various parts of my features. The technology works by creating a 3D model of the face, and by applying some clever mathematics, they're able to detect where different key features of the face are located and what textures are underneath those key locations. They then create a personal mean shape of each user to identify how this person looks in his neutral state. And as we know from extensive research by Darwin and Paul Ekman, expressions are universal in people, which means we can use that to detect the current expression and detailed facial movements for people across the world. Here's an example from earlier this week. Now, I'm not very facially expressive as a person, which gives you an idea of just how well this capability picks up on the trace emotions I do show. So right now, I'm looking at the world's top 50 soccer goals of all time. And I may not look thrillingly happy. Maybe it's being English, I don't know. But the system is picking up very distinctly reactions when I'm pleased at seeing a particularly good goal and showing the consequential response. One value of this technology is in shaping communications, which deliberately elicit emotions among a viewing audience to benefit a product and a brand. You might remember the VW Beetle commercial, which aired recently in the Super Bowl. I'm going to show it to you with the correlating level of happiness that trends throughout the commercial.
ever.
Get up off of that thing and dance to do you better. Get up off of that thing and dance to do. Sing it now.
Get up off of that thing and dance to you feel better.
Back and better than ever.
Get up!
Oh, that's great! No, the dog is funnier than the Vader kid. Sorry.
So obviously the Star Wars ending there was less than well received. You can see the trace drop there as people were trying to figure out what connection it had to the main piece of film that preceded it. Before we take a look at the future, let's summarize how much maps behave differently today. Compared to earlier maps, those in the digital era are starkly different. Today, the space we're concerned with is not geography at all. It's health, love, gaming, fitness, in fact, any accomplishment. We're not talking about an artifact now as a map. We're talking as part of a system. In terms of the status, it is the object that bends to the will of the user in order to be relentlessly useful. It's highly personal. This began with medical x-rays, but digital experiences today are highly individual. It's fluid, and in terms of time, well, it's real time. It's now no longer just a static rendition. So, to the future. It sounds like a Yogi Berra-ism. It ain't what it used to be. What does the future look like? You saw a few minutes ago how automated facial coding technology enables advertising to be crafted by understanding the emotions it triggers. A much richer benefit and potentially more valuable application, given how much of our lives are mediated through digital experience, is to use emotions to modulate digital exchange. For marketers, I think, this is a holy grail. They can anticipate the segments people belong to, the different need states and mindsets they might have, provide alternative interaction options and flows that attempt to channel the individual towards content and an experience that fits. But until now, the emotional response of individuals in the moment has simply been beyond reach. For this reason, the ability of marketers to engage people with the experiences that align with their emotional state has potential that is extremely valuable. On an opt-in basis, using the webcam almost universal in laptops or tablets to read the emotions of the viewer, it's possible to dynamically tailor on-screen experience to the emotional engagement of the individual in real time. I'm going to share with you an example of what it might look like. Our subject is Haley, who you'll see in a moment. And she's going to be searching for a winter vacation ideas for her family. The search experience is highly visual because pictures often evoke emotions better than words do. Okay, so that's the wrong video. There you go. So here are a number of different possibilities of different kinds of vacation that could be taken, and she wants a winter vacation, so picks the one on the right-hand side. And it gives an option of a number of different destinations. And based on her reaction, she wants to stay in the U.S. And she's then served up a number of different types of lodging. And based on her reaction and happiness level, she's made her pick. And now she has the option of different activities. And notice just how quickly her disgust at one of the activities gets replaced with a different option because it detects that there's something not right and offers her different possibilities. As she scans back here, she goes back to the one on the left-hand side, and that's not working for her, so it throws up another activity that she likes. And here with the end, she's picked her selection of different kinds of activities that are more sort of family kinds of experiences. And here it's possible to extend this reaction through expressions to serve up itineraries, have one picked that most aligns with her interest and her search criteria, and even get her to see whether she wants to embed a new activity in the itinerary she's already got. And by picking a restaurant, she can even choose the type of restaurant by simply smiling at the one that suggests family dining is most appropriate, and then even register the fact that she's willing to choose that itinerary and it can be mailed to her. Now, it's just a demo, but you get the idea. This kind of technology opens up the possibility of digital experiences in the future that are much more human. They offer up possibilities of a warmer feel when the elements respond naturally and fluidly and seemingly intuitively. So what else might the future hold in store? The idea of a singularity has been circulating for some time, and I don't think it will occur as extensively, perhaps, as it's been suggested, but I do think this is a period of sustained convergence underway with consumer data. It's happening because different aspects of our digital lives are increasingly able to be cross-referenced and linked together to form a richer repertoire of our composite behaviors and interactions that we're able to develop. While a growing chorus is increasingly vocal about privacy concerns, the availability of single sign-on across multiple sites expedites aggregation. Vic Gundolcher, in his talk yesterday about Google+, stated not just the ambition, but the plan to integrate all data across all of Google services together for precisely this kind of purpose. To this end, I believe that in the future, no maps will be the same. Any city grid will be populated with choices connected to a person's past data and social feed, and will exclude choices that are far away from a person's profile. Every behavior refines the knowledge to increase the accuracy of the map view. People are no more than the accumulation of every past experience and interaction. This is not people driving the customization. It's the intelligent system doing it based on tweets, comments, purchases, ratings, and so forth. Digital maps of the future will provide a highly personal understanding of the world around us and help us make our way through it. Here's what dating search might look like. An interesting possibility. So, to closing remarks. Today, it is more typical for maps to be thought of in a geographical way. And I challenge you, as marketers, as designers, and as contributors to the creation of interactive experiences, to think of them and their value much more broadly. While my talk today has traced the evolution of maps, we've traveled some 16,000 years in the last hour, I hope I've helped illuminate the element that lies at the heart of all maps and mapping behavior, spatial wayfaring. Why does spatial wayfaring matter? Because our minds are wired for it. It has had a hand in the evolution of our species. Spatial wayfinding is the mechanism we have for navigating a constant context of connections and relationships in support of a goal. We would do well to understand and better serve this primitive yet powerful cognitive ability. It forms the basis of our ability to make progress towards goals in all aspects of our lives, which has significant implications for what we buy. Thank you. I will be posting them to SlideShare. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. We've got about 9 minutes left, and if anyone has a question, happy to entertain it. There's a mic in the middle, and it really is helpful, I guess. The folks at the back of the room suggested this to me. It's helpful if you can come up to the mic if you've got a question. But interesting? Provocative? Yeah. I mean, when I was doing this, I didn't at all expect to find how deeply this notion of space exists in the mind. And we have really cognitive anthropologists to thank for that and the work that they've done, because it seems like in a very real way we have an inbuilt compass towards our connection to ideas that is spatial. So anytime anyone says a map is a geographic thing, you know, you have my permission to hit them and then point them to SlideShare, where I'll post this shortly. But it's really exciting because it suggests that there's so much more possibility that online digital tools and experiences can deliver to help people, as I said, make an emotional connection to something important and then actually make progress. And again, importantly, a progress on their terms. This isn't something like early maps that was an artifact and fixed and you had to bend to the map's will. The better experiences today, like Fitbit, for example, truly embrace the user and in a passive way and mold around them and effortlessly provide guidance so that you achieve more. Jane McGonigal yesterday talked, you know, very much about this notion in her talk. What was it, super better? Yeah, the idea of super better being a capability that the coaches and guides and uses game mechanics to nudge people forward. I would argue that's fundamentally a form of mapping. So if there aren't any questions, I'm around. Oh, yeah, please. Hey.
In mapping, the ocean is often the big blue spot on the map, and it's like a neutral space. Can you speak a little bit about the concepts you spoke about today, and especially your definition of maps that you use for your talk, and how it might relate to the ocean?
Sure. Yeah, my definition of a map is a visual representation of a space in support of an action. And that's probably the most important thing. Maps, there's a fantastic book called Social Cartography, which talks about maps as fundamentally being knowledge spaces. And that's really cool. And Ian has a section on strategy as a form of knowledge that can be mapped and understood and involves thinking over time. But to me, that's not enough as marketers to satisfy the requirement to trigger movement, behavior, and interaction, right? Marketers have to trigger action. If they don't, they're sort of irrelevant. The acquisition of opinions is not an action, in my view. We really want to encourage people to engage and ultimately buy. And so the requirement for a map to be in support of a future action was sort of critically and structurally important, which is, I didn't mean to diss on Minard's great infographic of the march on Moscow. I mean, it's a phenomenal infographic, but it's a nice piece of knowledge, but it doesn't do anything, you know, from a marketer standpoint to help advance the cause of getting people to buy. Does that answer your question? So an ocean, you know, is great, but it's a topographical feature, and a geographical one, an aquatic one, but it's not in itself activity related.
Cool speech. I have a half question, half comment.
Which would you like to have first?
It seems like what you're talking about is not just about mapping the human condition, but also about the ability to map human evolution. I mean, if you think about the emotion technology that you are showing us, we could put that together collectively and map how we as humans are evolving in our emotional reaction to things. And I just wanted to see if you had thought about that as you were preparing for this.
Yes, it's a great point. I'm merely showing examples at a point in time, but of course, longitudinally, you're absolutely right. I think this was a theme that Jane got into yesterday, if I can just so casually use her on a first-name basis, that when one's looking to recover from an injury, like concussion, I think it was she had, absolutely it's possible for interfaces and digital mapping to be able to register incremental improvements. You know, let's say if there's some physical impediment, response or reaction times can absolutely be measured, especially in a game-type situation, so that it's possible to understand what progress has been made. From a standpoint of civilization and mankind, I would go to my grave very happy if this somehow led to the ability for mankind's progress over time to be measured and the trajectory to be tagged. It's a great thought. Any other thoughts, questions, comments? Just all right. Well, thanks, and have a great rest of the conference.